We're talking about Wisconsin potholes on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Cars are designed to go over bumps, right? And usually nothing happens. But after this brutal winter we had, the pavement is battered and scarred. In Milwaukee alone, drivers have made 8,000 claims for pothole repairs so far this year. And that's compared to a little more than 3,000 last year. Has your car ever been damaged by a pothole? How big was it? Where did it happen? And how much did you pay? We're at 800-642-1234. Daniel Federle is executive director of the Wisconsin County Highway Association, and he's a registered professional engineer with the state of Wisconsin. He's also a professional land surveyor. Daniel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
So what is the condition of our state's roads? How would you assess how they're doing right now?
Well, this has been an ongoing discussion, obviously. We've seen with the last budget and the budget before that, in fact, that transportation and transportation funding is largely the issue that holds things up. Nothing that's new. It's a long-term decline. Unfortunately, Wisconsin's investment in their highway system, whether it be the interstate, state, or local roads, has not kept pace with the demand that we put on it. And so subsequently, as your story is talking about today, potholes are simply symptomatic of that decline in the system over the years.
So potholes in particular, are we having a particularly rough season with potholes? How are we doing?
Well, I would say yes. Certainly we had a very difficult winter, as everyone in Wisconsin knows, and that takes its toll. That takes its toll on the roads primarily. So the number of potholes certainly is affected by that difficult winter. But I think it's also more something that's coming to bear in terms of that long-term transportation investment and the lack of our investment in Wisconsin keeping pace with the needs on our system, the demand on the system, increased traffic, increased truck weights, a whole host of parameters that are working against each other, if you will, in transportation.
So, Daniel, Milwaukee is seeing an increase of complaints about potholes. So far, 8,000 pothole reports this year compared to 3,000 last year. Why is Milwaukee particularly more prone to an increase of complaints right now?
Well, I tend to take a little bit different viewpoint than many of my peers. I think certainly part of it is, as I've said, the decline in the system. We're seeing a general decline in the system overall, whether it be Milwaukee or the system outstate. The other thing that happens is I think that the reporting is a matter of not so much the potholes, but the density. In other words, you can spread 100 potholes across the county, and it doesn't get as much attention as if you spread 100 potholes across the two city blocks. And in Milwaukee, you have density and number, and so subsequently it gets more attention, gets more reporting. The other thing, quite frankly, is social media climate. You know, that's a whole different reporting mechanism than occurred before. Before there was social media and the things that allow people to report that way, people would have to call their highway department or call their public works department. People didn't take the time to do that most often. And so subsequently, I think part of the increase has to do with the mechanism for reporting as well.
Oh, yeah. It's easier to file a report now these days. Talking potholes, what to do with Daniel Federle. He heads up the Wisconsin County Highway Association. Have you ever reported a pothole problem? What did you need to do? Did your request get fulfilled, and how long did it take? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Daniel, help us understand, how do potholes form?
In a very broad sense, what you have is you have a pavement structure that is what people see as the blacktop, if you will, the asphalt. That's simply a surface course. That's like the shingles on the roof of a house, if you will. Underneath that is the structure of the roadway. That's the portion that carries the loads, carries the cars, carries the trucks. That's what gives you some structural support. What happens in our climate is with freeze, thaw, winter weather, etc., you get the asphalt, the blacktop cracks, and in that crack there goes water. And unfortunately, in the wintertime, it's water and salt combined. And that starts to thaw and cause the base underneath that pavement to get soft. Once the base gets soft, then impact from trucks and cars and vehicles driving on it begin to push the pavement down. The pavement breaks, and you end up with a pothole in areas where that water has saturated the base, and you don't have any structural support under the pavement anymore.
So how does a really wet spring, lots of rain like we've seen, impact the formation of potholes?
It increases it as well, because now you have ample amount of water to continue saturating the base. The base never gets a chance to dry out, and we keep driving over things. It isn't like we stop driving or we don't impact that pavement. And so under that condition, when you have ample water, it continues to saturate the base, keeps it saturated, and gives you a much higher likelihood of areas breaking up because there's no structural support anymore.
So we see crews all over the place working on roads, filling potholes. How are potholes filled?
Well, there's the dilemma with potholes is generally the filling is on a I won't say an emergency basis, but it's on a need response basis, if you will. In other words, there's a pothole, people are complaining, you need to get it filled. That's the primary objective. Now, that is a different methodology. The objective is to get it filled and get it filled as quickly as possible. And typically there's a multitude of different products that you can use. Some are less susceptible to cold weather, so they can be used when the temperatures are colder. Some are softer and easier to put in the potholes and flatten out. And then there are other ones that give you more of a permanent application. The problem is that if you're to do what we would call a permanent repair, then you're going to need to go in and repair some of that base that's been saturated and compromised as well. And so then you start taking out both the broke up blacktop, but the saturated base and that type of thing. And that's a little more involved. Certainly, but in high density areas like the city of Milwaukee or high traffic areas, that becomes problematic in itself. People just want the whole fix. They don't care, the long term methodology and what method you're going to use to fix the hole has no concern of theirs. They want the whole fix.
They need it done. They need it done right now. It almost sounds like a tooth filling at a dentist. We're getting a read on the state's pothole situation as we are in the thick of the patch and repair season. Daniel Federle is our guide. He's executive director of the Wisconsin County Highway Association, and he's a registered engineer with the state. Your pothole questions, your stories, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Are you a truck driver, perhaps? How frequently do you hit potholes on our roads, and which roads are notoriously bad for potholes? Do you live or work in an urban area? What's the status of potholes where you live? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're getting the lowdown on potholes here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Mechanics, they're dealing with damaged suspensions, tire blowouts, misaligned wheels, dented wheel rims, Drivers are footing the shop repair bills, and the cost to repair the damage caused by potholes, not cheap. It can be a couple hundred dollars to thousands. Have you ever reported a pothole problem where you live? What did you need to do? Did your request get filled, and how long did it take? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. The Wisconsin County Highway Association Executive Director Daniel Federle stays with us. Daniel, how does the funding work in terms of who pays to fill the pothole? The county, the city, the state? How does that work?
Generally, the pothole filling and things of that nature are out of general maintenance for the local units of government and also for the state, obviously. So depends on what roadway you're on, numbered roadways, state highways, lettered roadways, county highways, and then your local streets. And the local maintenance monies are most often, not 100%, but most often, certainly the 95 percentile, are funded through property tax dollars and then what we call general transportation aids. General transportation aids are a specific budget item in the state budget. And in simple terms, what it is it's a redistribution of the gas taxes and registration fees, a portion of those fees, and it's a redistribution back to local units of government. So in some general sense, it's a distribution of the gas taxes that, say, a local community's residents pay back to that local community, and it's utilized primarily, if not wholly, for maintenance, snow plowing, pothole patching, things of that nature.
And part of Governor Evers' transportation budget called for giving local governments a 10% budget increase to repair potholes and fix roads, but the budget has been rejected by Republicans. How important is road funding right now, and is there a way around that?
The road funding is absolutely critical. It is one of the most paramount issues for Wisconsin. We are at certainly a crisis point, certainly a dilemma. You know, as we indicated earlier, potholes are simply symptomatic of that system decline. Wisconsin roadway systems over the last several years have continued to decline. Local governments are in a very difficult position with levy limits and multiple demand for services at the local level. And so subsequently, the state and the legislature's inability to fully fund the long-term sustainable transportation in Wisconsin is showing up in terms of the roadway conditions. That is then in turn causing the problems in terms of potholes. It's affecting our ability to move commerce through the state. It affects our ability for tourism. It affects all of the factors that would be revenue generators for the state as a whole. And so we need to get to some kind of a long-term sustainable transportation plan. We aren't going to solve the dilemma in one. It didn't take us 1 year or one budget to get here. It certainly won't take 1 year or one budget to get out. But a long-term sustainable plan is absolutely critical to to Wisconsin in terms of transportation and our overall economy.
So how responsive are local governments to a resident's pothole report? Does it go in some type of database generally, or does it go into a priority list? Is an individual's report have some weight?
Oh, absolutely. There's absolutely no question. I was highway commissioner for 15 years. I work with all the highway commissioners in Wisconsin, and individual reports are absolutely a critical aspect. Highway departments regularly have section crews, people who monitor the roadway, but obviously with the number of miles of roadway, you can't be everywhere at all times. And so subsequently, there are multiple different mechanisms, if you will, in terms of how they log the report and how they address it. But in every case, there's a logging, and then there's a response to that report in terms of checking it out, and then providing the resources, both men, machinery, and materials to address those reports. So people reporting is absolutely essential in anything, not only just potholes, but, you know, issues with culverts, holes in roads, trees down. I had in the town that I'm in, I had reports of trees down this weekend with the storms that went through, and that's absolutely essential for us to get immediate response to these things.
So are we still fixing potholes, fixing roads in the same way with the same materials as we did decades ago?
No, I don't believe so. I've been doing this for, I hate to say, but just about 40 years now, and there's a significant difference in material types, and also in process. We have a much different material with polymer modified asphalts, with asphalts that perform at a much lower temperature, and typically potholes are a springtime thing. So there's a whole host of different materials and different methodologies now, as well as different equipments, different types of equipment that we use also.
Well, let's take a call now. Let's go to Marcus joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning. So I've been driving for 23 years, and I've noticed that the state of our roads in southeastern Wisconsin has deteriorated significantly, and it seems like the system is broken. So why don't we take and possibly approach this with like a paradigm shift of our mentality? During the zoo interchange construction, we had test sections of a type of paint that's only used on the German Autobahn to see how it worked for drivers. We're the only spot in the country that had that paint. Why don't we take a look at what the Germans have done with the Autobahn, where they actually put down a thicker road, more concrete, as opposed to asphalt, because concrete doesn't absorb heat the same way asphalt does, and so that'll help with global warming, as well as concrete, it'll last longer, and when you have the thicker base, they're doing repairs on average anywhere from 15 to 20 years, where on our roads, we're lucky if we get 4 to 8.
Marcus, thanks. Let's go to, back to Daniel on that. What do you think?
Marcus makes an excellent point. In a broader sense, innovation and innovative efforts are something that's absolutely critical to that long-term plan. And so subsequently, it's something that, in fact, Wisconsin and Wisconsin counties are a leader in the nation in terms of federal highway efforts called Everyday Counts, and some innovative things like warm mix asphalt instead of hot mix, utilization of concrete in various resurfacing projects, and Wisconsin counties regularly pursue those efforts. What I would also say is that We need to, the paradigm shift he talks about is something that I talk about on a regular basis, and that is when it comes to, for example, heavy truck loadings, and I know there's discussion in the legislature about increasing truck weights or wanting to increase truck weights once again, and it's a regular discussion. That's certainly in terms of economic impact and the ability for truckers to haul more weight is certainly a factor that needs to be considered. What we need to consider before we do that is that as a community, as a transportation community, as a state as a whole, we can't build every road to carry that increased weight. So we need to get to that paradigm shift where we identify priority routes, where these are loads that can go on these identified routes, and then we build them to adequate base and adequate strength to carry those loads. But the idea that we're going to build every road in Wisconsin to carry every increased truck weight is something that's just not sustainable in itself, and that's the kind of shift that we need to start thinking about and start working together on.
Really quickly, let's go to Rick in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm wondering, with the way the roads used to be processed, I guess you'd call it, filling potholes, they used to tamp the road by hand tampers or mechanical, and now they just throw the asphalt out and expect my expensive car or truck to just get slathered and rock dinged by it. And I'm wondering, is that a new system? We've gotten lazier, or is it just cost efficient to throw it down and let us do it, packing?
Yeah, Rick, thanks so much for the call. What's going on there, Daniel?
It's neither. It's not a cost or a new method by any means. A little bit earlier, I spoke to the multiple different, even though it's just a pothole, if we want to look at it that way, there are multiple different methods. Largely, the methodology where they have to just put the material in the hole and leave it is a more a factor of the location and the traffic volumes and the inability to simply shut down traffic or be out in that traffic for extended periods of time. You know, we put a great deal of effort into work zone and work zone safety, but having said that, simply setting up a full work zone for patching a pothole is not cost effective in itself. And so it has to do more with traffic volumes and where the traffic is and then speed of traffic as well.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. Daniel Federle is Executive Director of the Wisconsin County Highway Association, a registered professional engineer for the state. Coming up, we continue WPR's alcohol series, High Tolerance. This is the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And now we're continuing our WPR series called High Tolerance with a report from Phoebe Petrovic about one family bearing the greatest cost of excessive drinking. And this story begins on January 25th, 2002.
That morning, Kathy Shiflinski had taken her son Jake to his 5-year checkup, and she held him in her arms when it came time for the shots. That afternoon, Shiflinski drove down the highway, her 5-month-old Lauren dozing, Jake counting trucks.
He goes, "Mom, I think I want to take a snooze. Do you mind if I take a snooze?"
Shiflinski said, "Of course not," and Jake nodded off.
In my head, he was asleep. And that's important to me because he couldn't see what was coming.
Shiflinski saw a car coming toward her. It was in the median, then it was in her lane.
Do I stop? Do I play chicken? What do I do?
She turned into the ditch, but the car swerved back into the median, and it T-boned Shiflinski's car. The driver, Wallace Stenzel, had had 2 martinis that afternoon. His blood alcohol was 0.10, just over the legal limit. Shiflinski rode in the ambulance with Lauren. At the hospital, she found Jake lying on a table, wearing 1 shoe, his hand ice cold. The doctor told her Jake died instantly. When Shiflinski's husband Bill arrived, she didn't know what to say.
I felt helpless. I looked at him and I said, he didn't suffer.
Doctors decided to transfer Lauren to the children's hospital. Bill stayed with Jake and Kathy went with Lauren in the helicopter.
And so as we're flying over the city, all I could think of is Jake would love to be in this helicopter for the right reasons.
When they landed, Lauren was rushed in for another procedure. But eventually doctors said it wasn't working. They asked Shiflinski if she wanted to be with Lauren while she died.
And all you could hear was the machines, the beep, beep, beep. You know, no one was saying a word.
A nurse stepped out of the crowd.
She said, "You know, it's okay. You know, come on up. She can hear you. Talk to her." And I did. And I always would rub her little head. And then I, you know, was holding her hand and rubbing her head. And I said, "It's okay, Lauren. I'm sorry I couldn't save you. Go home and be with your brother." And then she passed.
The beeping stopped. Shiflinski says Lauren looked like a porcelain doll.
"I'm holding my little baby daughter, and she's dead. She felt like 100 pounds. And then my husband showed up, and he's looking at me, and I'm like, 'Do you want to hold her?' And of course he cried and sat down and held her and rocked her."
The driver who killed Shiflinski's children, Wallace Stenzel, spent 8 years in prison. Sometimes Shiflinski has to remind herself that her children died 17 years ago.
To me, it was like yesterday, and it's endless.
Shiflinski says she and her husband have struggled with depression and suicidal thoughts, but she also says they made a choice to figure out how to keep living. They had more children, twins named Tommy and Andrea. Shiflinski sought therapy, took antidepressants, and went to church.
"I believe I'm going to see them again, and they're with their Heavenly Father, and I pray for peace and understanding and guidance. And I don't know if I didn't have that, how I would be able to go on to the next date."
Shiflinski grew up in Wisconsin. She says she comes from a family of alcoholics, that her father drank himself to death, that her brother served several years in prison for drunk driving after Jake and Lauren died.
The night of the crash, my dad and my brother were drunk in my basement, and I'm sure one of them, if not both of them, drove home.
Addiction is widely recognized as a disease, but Wisconsin's drinking culture is potent. City groundbreakings and baby showers serve kegs. Wisconsin is the only state that classifies first-time drunk driving as a civil offense. Sheflinski refuses to call her collision an accident. She says it was entirely preventable.
How do you kill these cute little kids? I know you didn't mean to. But again, you had two drinks and they cost them their lives.
Jake and Lauren were just two of 292 people killed in alcohol-related crashes in Wisconsin in 2002. More than 4,000 people have died since. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you can read more about this story, see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. We're talking about the chemical glyphosate here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is the most used herbicide in our country, and the chemicals found in Roundup are used by many Wisconsin farmers, and that's according to new survey data. But Roundup's parent company is entangled in thousands of lawsuits. Are you a farmer or a gardener who uses Roundup? What do you think about concerns over its safety? Will you continue to use it? We're at 800-642-1234. Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse, and she recently wrote about the new survey data that found many Wisconsin fields are being treated with this herbicide. She's joining us from our La Crosse studios. Hope, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's first look at safety concerns. What are people claiming about Roundup in these lawsuits, thousands of lawsuits against its parent company, Bayer?
So what people are claiming is that exposure to Roundup, which is an herbicide that uses glyphosate as its base, they're saying exposure to glyphosate has basically caused their cancer. And this is based on a report that came out in 2015 from the International Agency for Research on Cancer. That organization found that there is a probable risk for cancer cause that glyphosate could be cancer-causing in humans.
How has the company responded to the lawsuits?
So far, Bayer has continued to insist that there is no link between Roundup and cancer. They are saying that they are appealing all of the three cases that have been decided so far against them. And they point to a report that was recently released by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And that agency found that there are no risks to public health from the currently registered use of glyphosate, the proper use of this herbicide.
So here in Wisconsin, how often are farmers using glyphosate, this active ingredient in Roundup?
So we know that glyphosate is used in 2018, was used on 42% of the corn acres that were planted in the state and used on 67% of the soybean acres that were planted in the state. This is based on a survey that was done by the state and the National Agricultural Statistics Service, which tracks agricultural chemical use in the state.
So how popular is glyphosate compared to other herbicides for weed control?
It's definitely one of the more popular herbicides that's used. Just looking at the numbers, it's the top herbicide used in soybeans, and it's second to atrazine, another herbicide in corn acres.
We're talking with Hope Kerwin. She's WPR's reporter in La Crosse. We're talking about the use of Roundup on Wisconsin farm fields and the controversial chemical ingredient glyphosate, which is the subject of lawsuits. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about perhaps water contamination or something else? What questions do you have about the chemicals that farmers use in their fields? You can join in, email ideas at WPR.org. Hope, what would happen to Wisconsin farms if glyphosate were taken off the market? Could there be a shift to different practices or products on fields?
Well, it would definitely affect farmers and affect their pest management practices. They would definitely have to make an adjustment. You know, I spoke with some researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and they pointed out that, there has been new interest not necessarily because of the court cases, but really just because we're starting to see the emergence of herbicide-resistant weeds popping up in the state of Wisconsin. And so there has been some new interest in looking at other management practices aside from chemicals to address some of these weed issues. He mentioned everything from cover crops to adjusting when farmers are planting their fields, or even just the space between rows in a field, as all possibilities for alternatives to look at weed suppression. But the researchers that I also spoke to, pointed out that Wisconsin farmers are oftentimes using herbicides sparingly already because it's an added cost for them. It's an input that eats at their bottom line. And during a time where we continue to see low commodity prices for corn and soybeans, it's definitely not something that farmers are going to be, spending a lot on.
Do you get a sense that crops becoming immune to herbicides because of production and use of them, is that an issue for farmers?
It's definitely an issue if weeds are becoming immune to these herbicides, because then farmers are left without a lot of options for addressing those weeds, and that can really affect their yields.
Let's go to Maddie now in DePere with a question. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. Actually, I have two questions, but one is did Bayer recently acquire the production of Roundup from Monsanto? Because I saw a documentary called Food Inc., where Monsanto actually forced many farmers into growing genetically modified seeds legally.
And Maddie, I want to pause right there with that question. And Hope, how is Monsanto in this relationship here?
Yeah, so Monsanto is the company that makes Roundup, and Bayer is their parent company. So that's their relationship.
So are Wisconsin farmers using this chemical as often as farmers in other states? How do we compare?
Yeah, so when you look at the numbers, we're seeing pretty similar percentages when it comes to looking at Wisconsin versus the 18 other states that are surveyed on their agricultural chemical use. And one of the researchers I spoke to actually said that in surveys that UW has done, that 40 to 50% of Wisconsin farmers are applying their herbicide in what he calls a one-pass program. So they're only going over their fields one time throughout a season. And he says it's in states that are farther south of Wisconsin, it's not uncommon to see multiple passes over a field with herbicide. And so it doesn't necessarily mean they're using more. It could mean that they're applying in lower percentages. So it's all very dependent on the individualized farm. That was another aspect in this, is that every farm has their own pest management program.
Hope, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter in La Crosse, and she joined us from our studios in La Crosse. We've been talking about the use of glyphosate in weed control, the main ingredient in Roundup that's been sold by Monsanto since the 1970s. Coming up, what did you eat for breakfast? Is it the same thing you've been eating for eons? We'll learn why we don't branch out on breakfast foods in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a moment to level on breakfast food. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When we think breakfast, we think cereal, and cereal can be traced back to the mid-1800s. Kellogg's created some of the most well-known cereal brands in the world.
Go with Tony the Tiger and get what it takes to start every morning. Kellogg's Sugar Frosted Flakes. Those great flakes from Kellogg's have a secret, you know. Toasted in frosting for the cat. On the go.
But we need to think outside the box and outside the Eggo waffles and Nutri-Grain bars, because Americans eat a very narrow variety of foods for breakfast. Do you eat non-breakfast foods for breakfast? What fills you up? We're at 800-642-1234. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Her piece about modern American breakfast is called I Broke Breakfast. Amanda, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So you woke up one morning, decided you wanted a chicken parm sandwich for breakfast, and realized that was really outside the box. So why is it that we eat such a small variety of foods for breakfast?
Well, the fact that we eat so few types of things for breakfast is sort of an American invention, and it's one that comes largely from marketing messages. Like you mentioned, the Kellogg's brothers were instrumental in introducing cereal to the United States, and both their business and the commonality of residential refrigeration has its roots in the Industrial Revolution. So as more families found themselves with refrigerators, found themselves without domestic servants who had been conscripted into a more formalized workforce, people started to need to eat something quick in the morning, and having refrigeration and being able to buy industrialized food was seen as a status symbol. It was seen as a marker of success because you could afford a refrigerator and fresh milk.
Well, take us back to Europe. How did medieval Europeans view breakfast, and how did that evolve?
It depends on whether you're talking about before or after the Reformation of the Church. When Europe was largely Catholic, breakfast was verboten. People found it gluttonous or sinful or a sign of a weak constitution if you needed to eat breakfast. You were supposed to wait until lunch. But once the Reformation of the Church happened, Protestants were a little bit more laissez-faire about breakfast, and it became a little bit more common to eat before work in the morning. And they ate, because this was far before refrigeration or industrialized food, they generally just ate leftovers from the night before. Breakfast was not a distinct food category for them.
Well, here on our continent, what did early Americans eat for breakfast?
Early Americans generally kept that tradition of leftovers alive and well, at least for the first couple hundred years of America. And then in the United States, breakfast became very regional because different types of crops, different types of livestock were cultivated depending on the temperature and the terrain available to settlers. That's why you see biscuits and grits in the South and different things in the North, different things in the Midwest. So it's very culturally regional.
We're looking at why Americans are stuck in a rut on breakfast food. And you can safely say millions of kids grew up eating cold cereal like Rice Krispies, Fruit Loops, Cocoa Puffs.
Puff, puff, Cocoa Puffs. Chocolate cake and Cocoa Puffs. Munchy, crunchy, chocolatey.
Cocoa Puffs. Yummy! I'm cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Amanda Moll is writing critically about breakfast as a staff writer at The Atlantic. She stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like the usual go-tos for breakfast, or do you find them boring? You can call in or tweet us, WPR Mornings. So, Amanda, how did breakfast change as America grew up and changed? I mean, we've been hearing the impact of advertising there in cereal commercials.
Yes, that is another big element of how the Industrial Revolution created American breakfast as we know it. As communications standardized, as television became more common in homes, as companies were able to send out truly nationwide messages about their products and services, the idea that these food companies could create the breakfast food as an idea, as a purchasable thing, became a lot easier. So that's where you get these cereal mascots like Tony the Tiger or Captain Crunch. They were ways for advertisers and food companies to reach out to create a brand that was not only recognizable to moms, but recognizable to kids. And a lot of cereal, a lot of breakfast food in general, is marketed directly at children.
We've also heard this advice about breakfast, you know, claiming it's the most important meal of the day. Where does that idea come from? And is it true?
That phrase was coined by the company that makes grape nuts in the 1950s or 1960s, I believe. So it's entirely a message intended to create the idea of breakfast as this distinct particularly important time of day in order to eat, not only to eat food, but to eat a very particular type of food. Actual research into breakfast is sort of split. Generally, a lot of researchers think that it might be good to eat something in the morning. There's no nutritional reason to eat breakfast food in the morning. And then there's also other researchers who are dissenters who have not found any evidence of a unique advantage to eating at all in the morning.
And why do we get stuck in a rut and eat the same thing every single day or the same piece of fruit every day? What is it about this repetition?
Well, humans in general are really habit-based creatures when it comes to food. And that's even more true in the mornings because, the Industrial Revolution formalized the workday, formalized the workforce in such a way that people don't have much time in the morning. There are not as many stay-at-home moms. There are not as many domestic servants to prepare food for people who need to leave the house during the day. So you get this very constrained period of time in which you can actually eat something. And when there's no time for thought or food prep labor, you hang on even tighter to these types of habits.
Well, I remember a few years ago we were making fun, I think, of millennials who didn't have time to sit down and eat some cereal, some cold cereal. So certainly economy and time has a lot to do with breakfast. It's getting squeezed.
Yes. One of the researchers I spoke with mentioned specifically that breakfast is the American meal that's most easily impacted by broad cultural changes. What we eat for dinner is a little bit more resistant to change, and the same thing with lunch. But breakfast has all kinds of cultural and psychological factors acting upon it that make it a very good indicator of how things change generationally and regionally.
How does socioeconomic class play into all of this?
Well, that goes hand in hand with the importance of marketing. If you can convince people that something, that buying or eating a particular type of thing is evidence of sophistication or success, then you have a really powerful way to market that product to people. And the idea that you would buy food that is only for breakfast, that is not meant to be eaten at other times, requires a level of socioeconomic flexibility that isn't available to a lot of people. Even in 2019, in the world at large, a lot of people are still eating leftovers from the night before for breakfast because it's a way to avoid wasting food and wasting money that they don't have.
So since writing this piece, have you tried to branch out for breakfast? Have you experimented anything beyond those chicken parmesan hoagies?
Yeah. I really love eggs, but I love eggs at any time of day. So I still eat eggs often for breakfast. But generally, I tend to grab leftovers. I tend to grab a little bit of cold cuts and cheese, just whatever's available. The thing that's important to me is that I don't feel hungry on the way to work. So really, anything that can make that happen for me is totally fine as far as breakfast food goes.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Amanda Mall is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and her piece about the modern American breakfast is called I Broke Breakfast. This is The Morning Show, where we come to you at breakfast or any time of day at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.